just what you want.
Okay, well, thank you. This is tape two. When the tape ended, we were talking about the Center for Urban Affairs, and if Dr. Wharton, if you could go back, we go back to your last summary statement about it.
Well, it was just that I was trying to develop it in a way where it would have a true disciplinary core of a, and would have its own line, budgetary line. And it did not, I don't know when it was eliminated. It was eliminated a few years after I left. And it was moved back to being a Center for Urban Affairs.
When the issue of athletics, athletics and academics, the push and pull between the two, especially at a large university, would you talk a little bit about that? About how it affected your presidency and...
You should ask my wife that one.
athletics and academics.
Well, first of all, there's no question but what athletics is and was an important part of Michigan State University. What gave me concern, or caused me concern, was not that factor, but the fact that there was a lesser attention being given to certain other aspects of the university in the extracurricular sense as well as the curricular sense. That is to say, you had a strong art faculty. But they were not getting anything like the attention that the athletic department was getting. You had some outstanding humanists on the faculty. They were not getting the attention. And this is, and I will not go any further than this to say, because this is where Dolores will come in, but when you looked at what we had as an auditorium, and you say, this is a major university, and we went to the University of Michigan to, what was it, Cranert? What was the one in Michigan? I forgot the one at the University of Michigan Performing Arts Center.
No, that wasn't the University of Michigan.
I forgot the name of the one in Michigan.
At the University of Michigan,
yeah.
It was the new one that was built
Power Center, that's right, Phil Power, yep. But anyway, but, you know, that auditorium... if that was a reflection of the cultural values of Michigan State, you know, forget about it, as the kids would say. Well, now, having said that, and I'll leave that part to Dolores, and she can talk about this better than I can, but in terms of her work with the artists and the rotating art as well as the Performing Arts Center, but in the athletic front, one of the things which I quickly came to realize was that the ability, the role that a president has is in trying to exercise real oversight over the athletic program is a very critical part of a president's responsibility. And the experience of going through our NCAA investigation taught me a tremendous amount about what really goes on. And I learned so much that the Big Ten athletic director used me as a resource with all the new presidents of the Big Ten whenever they come in. Because he said, go talk to Cliff and he'll tell you what to look for. I would not have known any of this. I don't think that all of many presidents would know this unless these things happened. And they suddenly begin to dig and find out what goes on. But it was a, it was quite an experience, quite an experience. One little vignette, when I announced the fact that we were under investigation and the press came, I think the press practically filled the whole boardroom, you know. And Bob Perrin and I said to each other, why can't we get this kind of coverage when we have these Rhodes Scholars? I mean, you know, I mean, but that was it. Now, I conducted the investigation very deliberately. I created a special committee, which included a trustee, to assist me in the investigation. I insisted that none of the information about the allegations should be made public until we had verified them. And the reason was very simple, and most people at first did not understand this. The list that we received were unsubstantiated allegations with no indication of who the persons were who made the statements. So if they said, we have reason to believe that Professor Charn Lee took an athlete and gave him his credit card and he bought 6 suits, I don't know whether it was Honhard who said it, Loris, anybody, all right? But it's on there. I don't know whether it's true or not. Now, if we had made that public, there are a whole series of possible consequences. Now, if it's untrue, then you sue me for having made this public. And all your reputation is damaged for having had this come out. So I insisted, no, we cannot make these public. The press, they wanted to know what the charges were. I said, you can't do that because you don't know who said it and you don't know whether it's true or not. And then we proceeded to do the investigation. The other thing, which was also very difficult for people to understand, is that given the nature of the procedures which existed then, I refused to go along and condemn out of hand those cases where it was impossible to make a determination of accuracy in cases where we didn't know who had made the statement. I mean, if somebody is, because secretly people can make these statements and ruin you, and you don't, you know, and they have no way of finding out who said it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's done out of spite or hatred or what have you. The cases where we found it, boy, we nailed them. But it was quite an experience.
Was there anything that in your background that prepared you for that?
I would say good old common sense and a commitment to justice and fairness.
Yeah,
that's much more important than the investigation itself. No, I mean that you just know what you're doing. I mean I. Plus, I had very good relationships. For example, it was clear that some of the allegations seemed to have been coming out of Ohio State. And I called up the then president of Iowa State, Harold Ennison, who was a good friend, and I said, I would like to come down and interview some of your student athletes, football, whom we attempted to recruit who came to Ohio State instead. And he set it up for me. And unbeknownst to us until we were pretty much through, Woody Hayes had rented a room above our room in the hotel, and he was channeling these student-athletes through his room down to us and then back up to his room. But I was able to find that out. I mean, it's you just go at it from the standpoint of what you think is right and fair. And it was very interesting that the outcome was really quite an event on the campus. It had some other consequences too. But
one of the consequences was the change in athletic directors.
Yeah, well, it was the coach. I mean, the athletic director, Fusak, stayed on for a while, but the coach went.
And Bert Smith.
And Bert, well, Bert did, yeah. Yeah. I was thinking of the faculty rep, yeah, right. But Bert left, and it was more, I think, you know, to a certain extent, it was more a matter that it happened on Bert's watch, really, to a certain extent. But the real malefactors, we nailed them. We knew who they were. One of the more interesting aspects of this, which I was writing up the other day, is that Denny Stoltz quite a few times publicly, years afterwards, was very critical of me, because he kept saying that he was released without, you know, proper due process and all that sort of thing, and he didn't know any of these things at all. And I've never revealed until I put it in this book that what he doesn't realize is that the first job he got after he left Michigan State, I helped him get.
At the University of Toledo.
Bowling Green. Yeah.
Oh, Bowling,
yeah.
Right. Bowling Green.
And what happened was the president there called me, and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I personally think that Denny Stoltz inherited a very messy situation. And I think he may have known what was going on, but if he did, he didn't do as much about it as he should have. I said, but I think he really was trapped. And I said, I think that basically he wants to be an honest coach and so on. I did. I said, that's what I told him. That's when he hired him. But Denny didn't know that, and I never told Denny this, you know. But I always was amused by the fact that he sort of said, oh, you know what you did to me.
Let me just say one. Mm-hmm. You may or may not care to answer, but I will raise a question that is common for those who followed that. And there was a lot of rumor, if you will, to the effect that you went into the NCAA hearing and learned that you hadn't been told the full truth by your own subordinates on certain aspects of the investigation.
No.
So that's
not that I don't remember anything like that at all.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
That's very interesting to hear, because things develop over time.
Yeah. No, I don't remember anything of that nature. I'll check and see, but those hearings are not to be believed. The staff of the NCAA who conduct the investigation to begin with and who put together all of the allegations then become the staff of the hearing committee, and they act as a prosecutor in the case in front of the committee. And you're sitting there and they're giving you these accusations, having given you the list to begin with, but without telling you who gave you the information. I mean, it's almost otherworldly. I mean, you're sitting there, and you're trying to answer these questions, but they don't show you what they've got. I mean, it's really a very, very odd kind of pattern. One of the committee members, it was very interesting, after this, sent me a cable in which he, in effect, as I remember it, said that he felt that one of the people, one of our assistant coaches, probably was should not be treated as harshly. And I thought this was true, too. But he agreed, although he didn't do that at the committee. But it was... we had... In terms of the really bad stuff, we had it. I mean, we had, and I won't go into all of it, but we had the really bad actors. We nailed. I mean, we really had them. Yeah.
When toward the end of your time at Michigan State, was there any thoughts, or did you actively seek a new job, or what were the circumstances? People had been approaching you prior, probably as soon as you got here, in government and business. Could you talk a little bit about those? If you wanted to, just in general terms.
Yeah. Well, it was, I guess my wife and I used to say regularly that no sooner had we gotten there, everybody had us leaving. It's hard to tell in certain cases how serious these things are. But for example, I mean, I was supposedly on the short list for Harvard, and that caused us turmoil on the campus. And when Carter was elected president, that's a very funny one. One of his aides called me and wanted me to go down to Plains, Georgia, because he was convening a group, and the group was Mike Blumenthal, Juanita Krebs, Cy Vance, Harold Brown, I forgot who else, there was one other person, and he wanted me. And I said, was very flattered, but I couldn't do it. I said, I operate as a nonpartisan, and the moment that I show up, that's it. I'm a dead duck in Michigan. So I wouldn't go. And years later, Dolores was on the board of Gannett newspaper, along with Rosalind Carter. And at one luncheon in Atlanta, Dolores was sitting next to the president, and she said to him, "Well, you can tell the story." Yeah.
Well,
you introduce yourself, yeah.
I usually go introduce myself at the Dolores Wharton so that he would know who I was. I said, "I'm Cliff Wharton's wife." He said, "Oh, I know who you are, and I invited Cliff Wharton to come to be a member of my cabinet. He refused."
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Mr. President.
But we've
had lovely relationships, yeah, with the Carters, both
but,
of us.
Yeah, but no, I wasn't searching. It was we had things were going fine. I mean, by that time the dissidents were all gone, and so it was working very well. And when the State University offer came along, that was one that really had some interesting. Now, interestingly, although most people don't know this, I was right at the penultimate stages on the SUNY one when Yale came after me. But I mean, it was. I think what had been accomplished at Michigan State, I think, attracted a lot of attention for both of us. And so that, despite some of our detractors on the campus, it was. But it was hard. It was hard for us to leave there. It really was.
Oh yeah, I was really very unhappy about leaving Michigan State.
Yeah, I
truly loved it. Yeah. We still do.
Yeah, that was probably the hardest change we've ever made.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In looking back at your career, and obviously because of time, we maybe can't go into some of the subsequent things. You're writing a book probably about your post-MSU career for sure. How would you assess your overall experience in terms of your own life, it coming at a time that it did, and in now in looking back, how important was your experience as president of Michigan State University?
Well, it obviously was a very important stage in our lives. I would have to say, with one exception, every stage of our lives has been absolutely marvelous. It really has, with all of the ups and downs. And they all were quite distinctive. The years we spent, when I was dealing with Latin America, or the years in Asia, or Michigan State, or SUNY, or TIA, they're all quite personally rewarding. I would say that at Michigan State, to a certain extent, it was the first time in our married life when we truly were able to operate as a team across the board. I mean, right across the board. I mean, it was not just segmented, the whole thing, because it's a total job. I mean, it's a 24-hour day, 7 days a week job. So that, people call the house. If I'm not there, Dolores takes a phone call. I mean, it's issues arise. It's an all-embracing, if you really want to do it right, kind of experience. And we became known as a team. And that's why the center was named for the two of us. It was not my presidency, it was our presidency in a very real sense, without Dolores being sort of Madam President in the way she operated. But it was, and I would have to say that I learned a lot. I learned a lot about running a university, which proved quite valuable when I then had to run 64 campuses, But I would say the bottom line on it is, it it is really hard for me to be a fair and impartial judge on it, for a variety of reasons. Not only is it personal, but also I think the perspective has to be there, a certain amount of time and distance to allow this to be done. And also, I find that there's a great deal of what I would call revisionism that occurs in the way people describe things and what happened. You say, I did so-and-so, and people say, oh, you did that? You know, I mean, it's like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, sort of thing. Not too long ago, I forgot, oh, I know, I was talking to one of the big fundraisers, retired now, and he had forgotten that Dolores and I are the ones who started the Capitol Drive, the first one they ever had at Michigan State. I mean, he should have known. I mean, this is his field. You know, he didn't know it. You know, he thought that, you know, somebody else had started it. I said, no, we started it. And then when he thought, oh, I guess that's right. You know, I mean, that kind of thing goes on all the time. And, you know, in time, this gets lost.
I want to, Fred?
I have a question for you, John. Mm-hmm. I just want to go back to one of the other central points of your administration, and that was you made a major change in the administration about more than that after when you relocated the administrator and the president of the campaign.
Right.
Would you care to comment about what led to that decision?
Well, first of all, Breslin was not changed by me. Jack's title was added to, period, by the board when I was appointed. That's all that happened. There was no other change in his responsibilities, no addition, no subtraction. John Cannon was a different case. When I arrived, John was provost, and he was a good provost, very good provost. Then Milt Mulder was due to retire, and I felt, as I looked at it, that John would be as good or better as a, whoops. But John Camplin was, I thought, as good or better as Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies. So I asked John if he would be willing to move over, and he said sure. So he did, and that's when I moved Larry Boger in as provost. But it was no dissatisfaction with John at all, quite the reverse. And John always had been a great team player, and he was just great as Vice President, and he was great as provost. But that way, I got two strong people. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other question I had, you mentioned Walter Adams, mm-hmm. the interim. How would you describe your relationship with him during your presidency?
I would say, maybe it's in Dolores' reaction to that. I would say that my relationship with Adams was, at times, distant or prickly, mainly because, well, I'll give you one example. When I was working hard on creating the College of Urban Development, one day in the halls, he stopped me and he said, "You're trying to destroy, you know, this wonderful program." And I said, "No, I said I'm trying to save it." And I said, "You just, you know, let me try to get this done." You know? But he was convinced that I was trying to, you know, destroy the program. I said, "No, not at all." When it finally went through and I got it through the state legislature, you know, he never said a word. There were a number of occasions when, and I never said anything to him about him publicly, but there were a number of occasions when he would sort of adopt positions which were sometimes detrimental
he and Lash LaRue. And I guess it was also part and parcel of a very important difference in style in management. The former trustee, who's dead now, of Michigan State, he said that he said Walter Adams likes to, you know, play to the gallery. He says, and you want to provide leadership. I mean, he said that's the difference. I don't know how accurate it is, but no. And then when I left, as I was leaving, Walter Adams said I neglected the university. And several of the members of the Board of Trustees blasted the living daylights out of him for having said that, and started listing all the different things that I'd done. You know, it was, I think, to a certain extent, his continuing unhappiness that he didn't get it, and he really wanted it. This is a guess, I just don't know. Now, with Pauline, his wife, we got along fine. You know. But, you know, he never got over it. Yeah. And yet, I didn't have a thing to do with it. I mean, I didn't go out to, you know, prevent him from being president, and that wasn't my role. So.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of the project,
okay.
Certainly, and appreciate your contribution.
Good. Okay. Now you can do Mrs. Wharton.